Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes us human? How smart can brains possibly get? Why does turkey make our mouths water while grubworms gross us out? And why is Google Maps such a great tool for finding one's way in the world? This might sound like the most scattershot hour of Think in our history, but in fact, my guest today has explored all of these questions and many more in his job as host of Nova Science Now and personal technology columnist for The New York Times. David Pogue is in town, along with Nova senior executive producer Paula Apsell, for a KERA member event this evening on the SMU campus. You can reserve a seat by emailing friendsofkera@kera.org. For now, we are delighted to have David Pogue join us in studio to talk about the ways science is changing our world and how we understand it. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Talk a little bit about, for the Nova Science Now programs, how the topics are chosen and sort of what you want to understand before you even go into taping something.
Well, it's a magazine show, so there's four stories in each hour's episode based on science, obviously. And Nova, of course, has been around for decades. Mm-hmm. Nova Science Now is kind of a spinoff. It's meant to be more family-friendly, not quite so dense. And in particular, it's meant to be entertaining. This is the twist this year with my debut as its new host. There's some good belly laughs in there. Each episode is centered around one central question. And this, too, is new this season, is this effort to wrap around a continuous theme, not just four scattershot stories, but four themed episodes, segments on the same thing. So what are animals thinking, or how smart can we get, or what will the future be like? These are all the names of some of the episodes this season.
I think what's really interesting about them, and I have to say my kids are huge fans, it's the only show they're allowed to watch on a school night. And so they're always very excited. But there are ethical questions along with the scientific knowledge. And I'm thinking of, I think it was the episode that ran last week, about the application of science to solve crime or prevent crime. And there's this question about, are the brains of people who tend to be violent different from the brains of people who don't? And you don't go into it so deeply, but it's there for us to think about.
There are ethical questions up and down, especially with last week's episode. And of course, the great thing about these being PBS is that all these shows are online for free anytime you want them at pbs.org. So one of the stories last week looked at the so-called warrior gene, which is actually a gene that all of us have, but there's a mutation of it that some people have that makes them hyper-violent. The number of people who have guns or are in gangs or convicted of crimes tend to have a much higher percentage of people who have this mutation. So the question is, well, does that mean we should use this to screen people? Should we not hire someone? And what we found out in doing the story is that it's a lot more complicated than you have the gene, you're a bad guy. It doesn't really sprout into violence unless you also had a rough childhood. Mm-hmm. So a happy, loving childhood, the gene won't even make itself known. But there are some other things we did. We studied the lie detector. The polygraph test has been around forever, and it's inadmissible in court in 49 states. It's just too easy to fool. Mm-hmm. Not by me, by the way. They made me take – we went to this incredible FBI training facility where they have a fake bank – tellers, a teller desk, a fake hotel room, and a fake office. And the reason is they send recruits like me in to rob one of these things. And even though it's a mock robbery, the polygraph will still the operator will still ask, did you take the money? Mm-hmm. And you will still react. So they had me take money out of a coat hanging in the mock hotel room. And later, boy, did I blow the lie detector. It's like my sweat graph was literally off the chart. I mean, it was above the highest. So I'm a really bad candidate. But psychopaths can actually fool the polygraph. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what can replace it? And they're looking experimentally at some really wild things. What we showed on the TV show last week was they study your brain. They give you an EEG. And they've determined that they can see chemical changes in activity in your brain right before you lie. Mm-hmm. In the milliseconds before a lie, you pre-process the lie. And you can't help that, even if you're a psychopath. What didn't air that made me sad was the coolest thing ever. They're also working with eye tracking software. So they had a laptop there, and they would show me a picture, and the laptop's webcam could tell what part of the picture I was looking at. And the reason this is a great lie detector is they'll show the suspect a photograph of the murder scene in which they have photoshopped the body into a new place in the room.
Huh.
So only the real guy who did it will instinctively flick his eyes to where the body is supposed to be.
Wow.
Because no one else would know.
Mm-hmm.
It's really kind of brilliant.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing. And what I love about the show is that apparently there is nothing that you can't do. And I don't know what your contract looks like. But you are sort of the willing guinea pig for all this stuff.
That's right. Yeah, that was the formula. I mean, this whole ride for me now in its third year is completely amazing. I'm not a scientist. I wasn't a science major. They chose me two mini-series ago for a series on PBS called Making Stuff that was about the singing, dancing subject of materials science, which nobody knew what to do with. It just seemed like it's invisible. It's the subatomic level and molecular interaction. It sounded kind of boring. But they found this really genius producer, this guy named Chris Schmidt, who's now one of my good friends, who said, here's what we'll do. Unlike most Nova shows, we'll find a host. He won't be a scientist. He'll go in there to the lion's den with the scientists and force them to translate what they're saying into, you know, English that everyone can understand, somebody who's funny and curious, and we'll immerse him in the science. So to demonstrate the tensile strength of steel, we'll stick him in the backseat of a demolition derby car. And to talk about the bacteria-repelling qualities of shark skin, we'll send him down to the bottom of the sea to handle 12-foot reef sharks. And, you know, so it was all these really dangerous but exciting situational science things. And it was an incredible formula. I mean, it made for fantastic TV, and you would just never forget any of the points we were making because they were so vividly illustrated. So to the extent possible, we're carrying that over into Nova Science now. So, yeah, I've had my brain scanned. I've taken IQ tests. This coming Wednesday's episode is called How Smart Can You Get? And it explores the upper reaches of brain capacity. And one of the things that was really mind-blowing was these memory champions.
Mm-hmm.
There's a U.S. memory championship, and we went to it. I entered it.
Mm-hmm.
I came in last place because I don't know the tricks. But they give you a deck of cards,
mm-hmm.
and it's shuffled, and they give you 5 minutes to memorize the sequence of cards. And most of these guys do it in 5 minutes. Or they will parade a series of people onto a stage and say, this is Bob. He works in insurance. He lives in Houston. He has 4 children. Their ages are 7, 9, 11, and 13. And then, you know, there's 15 of these people in mm-hmm. 5 minutes. And then you're asked to reconstruct all this. So what – and these guys – oh, and the other one is they give you a sheet of numbers – of two-digit numbers, covered with numbers, and you're given 5 minutes to memorize them.
So there's no making up a song or whatever that you might do for a phone number or something.
Yeah, so I managed to memorize 12 of the numbers. Mm-hmm. The winner did 303. So yes, you're absolutely right. There is a trick.
Did you do the Memory Palace thing?
I did the Memory Palace mm-hmm. thing, right. So then later, I learned what they're doing, which mm-hmm. is in their heads, they're converting these random bits of information to information they already have memorized using this ancient thousand-year-old trick called the Memory Palace. Very impressive that you know what it is. And for example, they gave me a list of 40 random nouns: monkey, kite, fire, Kleenex, whatever. And I was given 5 minutes to memorize them.
Mm-hmm.
But I was taught the trick this time, which is you first imagine a room of your house, something you know well already that you could recite off the top of your head as you walk through your house. What do you see? Kitchen, couch, window, bathtub, whatever. And you associate each noun on that list with the sequence of objects in your house. So window was the monkey. I pictured a monkey bursting in through the window. Then couch was fire. I pictured the couch on fire, and so on. And in 5 minutes, I was easily able to remember these linkages using the sequence of my palace, my house, as the guide. So all these guys use memory tricks like that. They don't actually memorize 303 digits. They memorize Marilyn Monroe eating a fudgesicle while riding a bike, being chased by a bear.
What happened when you put your brain head to head, as it were, up with Einstein's?
Oh, wow. That was weird. So Einstein's brain is a great story. When he died, the pathologist at Princeton Hospital did the autopsy and stole the brain. He took the brain. He didn't let scientists look at it. He absconded with it. At one point, he actually drove across the country with this thing in a picnic cooler in the back of his car.
And it's like a Coen Brothers movie, right?
Yeah, very much. It sounded just like one. I think they should take note. But he did take photos of it and send that to scientists, and he would take slices of it, of tissue, and send those to people. And it turns out Einstein's brain, which of course is considered one of the smartest ever, has some unusual physical characteristics. If you look at your brain from the top, of course it's all folds and squiggles, but they roughly fall into three walls on mm-hmm. each side of the dividing line. Einstein had four on one side, so we don't know if that had something to do with it, but. This is not on the show because they thought it would alienate viewers who thought that I was trying to lord my brain over other people.
Do you have extra folds?
I have a fourth lobe as well.
Wow. Well, you did go to Yale.
I did go to Yale, summa cum laude. But mainly it's useful with my kids. I'll say, hey, I'm right. I have a fourth lobe. almost always works.
I'm going to have to try that. I don't know if I have a fourth lobe, but it might be worth it.
Exactly. The kids won't know. I'll let you show them my x-ray scan. And the other thing that was interesting, Einstein's brain on the right side, where the area is that controls your left hand, had an enlarged, swollen fold. Hmm. And that's because he was a violinist his whole life. And not many people realize, but you can actually change the shape of your brain. You can exercise it and enlarge pieces of it like a muscle. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens. If you're a violinist, your left hand is constantly in motion and you are exercising the part of your brain that operates the left hand. So it was no surprise to find on the left side of my brain a similar enlarged fold because I'm a piano player and I do a lot of stuff with my right hand. But they've done stuff like this. They gave 14-year-old teenage girls who'd never played Tetris a Tetris game and asked them to play for 3 hours a day for a month. And they observed these girls' brain shape changing from playing video games. Really wild stuff.
So do you think musicians are formed in utero, or do you think that it's a matter of exposure and experience?
It is absolutely genetic. No question about it. I know that because I'm a hardcore musician, and without any effort on my part, my three children are even more music-oriented than I am. My parents tell me that when I was two, I would sing a note, and then point to each of them to sing the additional notes of the chord.
Really?
It was like a little activity, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could barely speak, but I would make them sing. So I think it's inborn. I mean, as with anything, I'm sure environment helps. It'd mm-hmm. be good to have a piano teacher if you show proclivity for the piano. But
are you good at math?
I'm pretty good at math. Mm-hmm. My kids are prodigies at math. In one of the episodes, in fact, in the brain episode, we met these calendar savants. These are people with mild or sometimes severe autism who nonetheless have incredible mathematical skills, just like in Rain Man when they spilled the toothpicks on the floor and he
counts them instantly.
Yeah.
And so they know like Christmas Day 1461 was on a Wednesday.
That's right. And my son learned the formula for that, and he can do it in his head. Not as quickly, but it can be done.
David Pogue is with us. He's New York Times technology columnist and host of PBS's Nova Science Now. He's in town for a KERA member event this evening on the SMU campus. You can find information about that by emailing friendsofkera@kera.org. We'll come back to our conversation in a few minutes. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times personal technology columnist and host of PBS's Nova Science Now, David Pogue. He's in town for a special KERA membership event this evening on the SMU campus. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So I was super excited. Actually, our whole family was when you went through and found out how much Neanderthal DNA you have.
Yeah, this is true. This is a really cool story. It turns out there used to be four species of people. Mm-hmm. Like there are 17 species of penguin and, you know, hundreds of kinds of birds. There were four of us. Now there's only one. But there used to be four different species, and they lived in different parts of the world. But they found some remains of one of these species, which we've heard of, Neanderthals, in the Neander Valley of Germany, thus the name. And they actually recently were able to look at the genome of Neanderthals. Mm-hmm. And to their astonishment, they found that we have between 2 and 6% Neanderthal DNA in us. Now, how could that happen if we're a different species? There's really only one way that could have happened. Our ancestors had sex with Neanderthals. They went up to Europe and interbred. So horrifying to a lot of people. But you know, to my mind, it sort of gives me an out when I, you know, leave clothing on the bedroom floor. I'm like, hey, it's the Neanderthal in me. So, yeah, they studied my genome, and I have 2.6% Neanderthal DNA.
I actually do, too, because we've done these tests, and my son has 2.8%, so he feels like he's number one, you know. But it's fascinating to discover this stuff about yourself. I remember when the information first came out and there was something that was written up that Ozzy Osbourne had Neanderthal DNA, and I was laughing about it and isn't this funny, and then I find out that I've probably got just as much as he does.
You probably do. But in classic Nova / Pogue tradition, they decided to illustrate this principle by having a former Industrial Light and Magic makeup artist come and make me up as a Neanderthal. It was 7 hours in the makeup chair. They made, you know, latex appliances for my brow and my nose and my chin. And then they sent me loose through the city of San Francisco for a day dressed as a Neanderthal. It was a sight to see. A lot of people thought we were making a Geico commercial.
I wonder, yeah, if people noticed that you had this strange-looking face or that you had a camera crew following you and, you know, what the combination was.
Well, actually, the surprising thing was how few San Francisco residents even turned their heads.
Well, they're very tolerant out there of all kinds of things. Talk about this. So when you're deciding on what to write about for the New York Times, I would imagine every manufacturer, developer of new consumer technology wants to be your best friend. How do you filter through even the pitches that you get when you're deciding objectively what deserves coverage?
That's right. It's a very good question. When I signed on with the New York Times in 2000, the assignment from that editor that day was, we don't care just about the gadget. We want to know what its effect is. So how does it change things? So yes, I get pitched constantly by the PR people of all the electronics companies and so on. And the simple criterion is, you know, how does it change things? Is it the first, the cheapest, the best, the fastest, the smallest? Does it change the game in any way? Is it relevant to people because it's a well-known company? Is it relevant to people because it's a company no one's heard of with a really great idea? Mm-hmm. So that's really the selection criterion.
And then I suppose you must like it because this is your job. But for me, the thought of learning a new tablet computer system, a new phone, a new whatever on a regular basis just to sort of familiarize myself sounds very, very stressful.
Man, all I can say is if it weren't my job, I would be really stressed out. I'm supposed to be on top of this. I go to the meetings and the conferences and read the blogs and the magazines. And even for me, it's like drinking from a fire hose. I mean, mm-hmm. It's just so much stuff coming so fast all the time. I really don't know what I would do if I were the average person. I mean, I would just feel constantly behind the curve. And I do anyway. Mm-hmm. So the one thing that keeps me going is that I feel like it's to some extent I'm providing a service for people who don't have their whole career to spend reading and immersing themselves in this stuff. I'm cherry picking what matters and giving them an assessment to save them money.
How much time do you spend answering email from like your cousin from 25 years ago who wants to know what kind of phone to buy himself?
I'm supposed to answer all my email. That's the New York Times policy.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's not quite fair because I'm the tech columnist. So I think I get a lot more than the other columnists.
Yeah.
But I use speech recognition software, mm-hmm. and I just speak my responses, and I have a lot of canned replies. You know, people will – I get a lot of hate mail.
Mm-hmm.
I've discovered from this job that that people sort of define themselves by their gadgets. So
yeah.
if I insult their gadget, I insult them. And just the most rip-roaring, insulting, foul, you know, you should take your blank and shove it up your blank, you know, kind of email. And so I have these macros I'll say or type just a short response like buzz off, and that spills out a boilerplate response that's much longer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess we'll have to agree to disagree on this one. Thank you so much for taking the time to write. Just wanted to take this personal moment to say, you know, like that.
Yeah. It is interesting, though, that, you know, we have now this new set, as you mentioned, of criteria by which to define our identities. It used to just be what you wore, maybe what you drove. And now it's true. Like, I'm an iPhone person, and it's not like I don't like the Android people. But when I see somebody else with an iPhone, I think we have something in common.
It's incredible. And it's skewing our judgment in alarming ways. So the classic example is the Windows phone.
Mm-hmm.
So Microsoft, against all odds, Microsoft the copycat, Microsoft the mediocre, came up with this with this phone software called Windows Phone 7 that is not a copycat. It's fresh. It's arguably better than the iPhone and the Android. Android was a copy of the iPhone. And it's gotten ecstatic reviews. Everyone who has one loves it. But it simply isn't cool. It just doesn't have the coolness for some intangible reason that, trust me, Microsoft would love to figure out. And so it's fewer than 4% of the phones that are sold are Windows phones, even though it is arguably the best one out there. So isn't that weird?
Yeah.
Like, you can't even think straight because of this cool factor.
How does the new Surface tablet, how does that match up with all its competitors now?
Well, it's really interesting and very, very confusing. This will be the subject of my column this week and everybody's column this week comes out next week. It's a lot like the iPad, but for the money, you get a lot more equipment. You get twice the storage. You get jacks, like you can plug in a keyboard or a mouse or connect a TV. But the really interesting thing is it has a flip-out kickstand. The back half of the back panel is a very thin, unnoticeable hinged panel that flips out when you need it. And they make these magnetically attached screen covers, just like the one for the iPad, except that on the inner surface is printed a keyboard, a touch keyboard. So the point is that when you need a real computer on an airplane tray table, for example, flip out the kickboard, flip down the screen cover, and suddenly you have a proper desktop computer in 1.5 pounds. It could change the game. Now, the confusing part is the one that goes on sale next week doesn't run real Windows software or any of the thousands of iPad programs or any Android programs. It's a whole new software platform for which there are very few apps. So you're basically buying a tablet that runs – it comes with a streamlined version of Microsoft Office.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool, but nothing else. In a few months, they're going to come out with a pro version that's thicker and heavier and more expensive. It'll be $1,000. But that one will run actual Windows programs, Quicken, Photoshop, whatever. And that, I think, will be more of a game changer because suddenly in a 2-pound package that can be a tablet or not, you have a real working desktop computer.
We have an email here from Maggie in Fort Worth who writes, I was one of thousands of participants in the Twitter crowdsourced book that you compiled a couple of years ago. It was a fascinating experience. It created some interesting and very funny results. But I want to know what you took away from that exercise. I don't know if it made money, Maggie writes, but what else in the nature of researching the process of crowdsourcing information did you learn?
That's a great question. This was one of the most exciting experiences of my life. I wrote a book called The World According to Twitter. Actually, I didn't write it. I posed a provocative question each night. Make up the subject line of an email you really don't want to open. Compose a Chinese proverb that sounds authentic. Tell us about your first love. Things like this. And then I would publish the funniest results in this book. I had 500,000 followers at the time. And the first thing I learned was the group on Twitter is a very different crowd than the rest of the internet. Research has later shown they're a much more they're a much older crowd, the average age 35. They're a much better educated. The average income is $75,000. So this isn't
the Twitter crowd is older.
The Twitter crowd.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not 11-year-olds in the comments of YouTube. These are not morons. These
right.
tend to be smart, interesting, very very funny. Like the one I said, make up a prequel for a famous movie, and they came up with things like Mr. Smith MapQuests Washington, and we're running low on Mohicans. So they're really really clever. And the second thing I learned is the importance of a title. It was called The World According to Twitter, and it sank like a stone. Nobody bought this book, and I think it's because people thought that it would be about Twitter or a how-to book on Twitter. I don't know what the title should have been. How do you express this gimmick that I did in four words? But I know it didn't do well. But it's too bad because the people who do have the book laugh their butts off.
Do you have ever like a Luddite weekend where you close the laptop and go out to the beach or something or take a walk and have absolutely no connectivity?
No. What's the next question?
Do you wish for that, or are you uncomfortable? Do you get kind of itchy when you are disconnected?
I would be totally fine with it. I'm a very deadline driven person though, and there's always I do a bunch of stuff. I write a column for Scientific American. I write how to books for computers. I do a lot of speaking. So I have a lot of masters,
mm-hmm.
and so there's very rarely a time when they would permit me to disappear. But I'm not one of these people whose hands would start shaking if I'm not near my computer for a couple of days.
What do you think accounts in this country for? It seems like there is a great hunger for new technology and new developments. At the same time, there is sort of a subset of the American population that doesn't accept things like evolution, doesn't accept the idea of climate change. How is it that we embrace science really wholeheartedly in some areas and not in others?
This has also been another area of research and learning for me. I think there's so much fear. I think we're human beings. We're these little entities on a spinning blue dot in space. We feel insecure. We don't know what our purpose is. So there's certain things that we cling to hard for reassurance. That's got to be what it is. I'm doing a story for CBS Sunday Morning right now called The Last Global Warming Story. And we're trying to go to the top experts and the top deniers and the top most knowledgeable people to hammer out what exactly we know and what exactly we don't. And it turns out that there is no longer any dispute about global warming, about climate change. There aren't deniers anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they're insane, because even the most skeptical skeptic now has reams of data. So there is still plenty of debate. What do we do about it? How much global warming? How long will it take before the weather changes and so on? Yes, there's plenty of debate. But there's not any longer any realistic way to say climate change isn't happening. And yet, you poll the Americans and you're right. They just would rather go blah, 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 and I don't care about the scientific evidence. It's more secure for me to believe what my mother and father told me, more secure for me to believe that we're all going to be okay, that I won't have to make changes to my life because change is frightening. So I think it all boils down to psychology.
Well, when you talk about psychology and sociology, it's interesting because it strikes me as the first time in human history where there has been this sort of impending disaster that we have a great deal of advance notice about. That was never the case before with natural disasters.
That's true. And really, if you think about people the way they are, people have a hard time en masse making changes for the benefit of the future, even on the tiny scale.
Mm-hmm.
They do that experiment with preschoolers where they say there's a cookie in front of you. The researcher is going to leave the room for 20 minutes. If you don't eat the cookie, he'll give you two cookies when he gets back. And they eat the cookie. They can't think ahead. They can't plan for rewards. We know if we smoke, we die. We know if we overeat, we die. But we do it because we can't take the future seriously enough. So when you try to sell people on the idea of, guys, we have to make some changes now because the Earth in 50 years will be a very different place, that's a tough sell.
Do you feel like in some ways an evangelist of sorts?
No, I'm really nervous, actually, about this story and all these stories. Like I say, hate mail. I mean, I'm telling people.
It still bothers you to get hate mail.
Oh yeah, I'm fairly thin skinned. It's tough. And the science stories I'm doing now, I can only imagine. I mean, I'm stepping right on people's raw nerves about global warming and, in the case of Nova Science Now, scientific topics. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a little. Although here again, human nature is the most fascinating part. I'll review some phone. And I'll get hate mail saying, you know, you idiot, your mother was a this, and that's a stupid phone, and you shouldn't like it. And so my typical response is, thanks so much for your note. If you care to rewrite it civilly, I'd love to discuss it with you. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing is 99 out of 100 times they follow up by saying, oh, my gosh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I was really cranky that day.
I didn't know there was a real person on the end of this.
I didn't know there was a real. That's exactly it.
Yeah. Right?
The anonymity of the internet breeds screaming because you don't think anyone is listening. And when it turns out somebody is, you're like, oh, I'm sorry.
That's another little unintended consequence, don't you think? We created all these systems and we didn't necessarily think that there would be these trolls out there kind of, you know, just expressing their rage at any possible opportunity.
It's true. And it's very easily solved, by the way, that the difference between the internet and real life interactions is anonymity. Mm-hmm. So let's end the anonymity. I cannot, after many years of thinking about this, come up with a single reason we shouldn't be known online by our real names. I mean, yes, okay, there would be AIDS boards and breast cancer boards where we'll use pseudonyms. But for reviewing an Amazon book or on a political blog discussion, what's the harm? It would end the hostility, a lot of it, and our reputations online should be something we carry around like we do in real life.
David Pogue is with us. He's New York Times personal technology columnist and host of PBS's Nova Science Now, among a host of other jobs that he does. He's in town along with Nova's senior executive producer Paula Apsell for a special KERA member event this evening on the SMU campus. If you'd like to attend, you can send an email to friendsofkera@kera.org. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-933-5372. We'll take those calls after the break. You can also email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with David Pogue, who is host of PBS's Nova Science Now and personal technology columnist for the New York Times. He's in town for a special KERA member event this evening on the SMU campus. If you'd like to join us, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from Jim in Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Thank you, dear. My question is probably too elementary, but I have used a computer for years, but I have never really become very proficient at it. And I'd like some guidance on how to train myself or go about training to use a computer to its maximum. And thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
If you want to learn a regular computer, I mean, the obvious sources are books and training classes and a friend. So I actually used to write those blah, blah, blah for dummies books, mm-hmm. and they're very simple and very patient. There are local college courses that will walk you through them too. And, of course, getting a buddy to show you the ropes, you know, somebody under 15 is always a great solution. But the other question is, do you even need a computer anymore? I mean, if you really want simple, if you really want to master something instantly, consider an iPad. So, you know, there's email, there's web browsing, there's just about everything you might want to do, or this upcoming Microsoft Surface, same thing, without having to learn the complexities of a whole operating system. There are no menus, there's no nested folders, there's no dialog boxes. It's just like hitting buttons on an elevator.
You know, in some ways, I feel like I'm getting smarter and smarter when, in fact, the technology is getting smarter. And you have to know less these days than you did, you know, 15 or 20 years ago to use any kind of device. Can you talk about this for a minute? You wrote this. You wrote the For Dummies books. You did the Missing Manuals series. What is missing from manuals, and why aren't they written in such a way that most people can easily absorb them?
Wait, you know of manuals?
I'm from the 80s. Yes, I remember.
In my
experience,
they've completely disappeared. Mm-hmm. You open a – first of all, you download your software. So there's obviously no printed manual. Or even the ones you buy in the store, you get a DVD and a registration card and nothing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that was – I kid, of course, but that was the purpose behind this missing manual series that
but
I
started.
But it's
kind of like, good luck, genius, figure this out.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly mm-hmm. right. And a lot of the stuff that we use, you know, all of Google's services, for example, Google Voice and, you know, the Google Drive and Gmail, they're free services. So the deal is, we'll give you this, but we're not going to give you any kind of support. We won't help you. There's no instructions, maybe some online pages. So the printed manuals have disappeared. I've done some research on this for a couple of reasons. One is it's a dollar per box mm-hmm. and, you know, times hundreds of thousands of copies for something that a lot of people don't read. They don't read the manuals for their software anyway. And the second reason is that it's time to print and bind and get ready for shipping, where when the piece of software is finished, they want to ship it right away. Mm-hmm. So they don't have time. So that's why regular software manuals disappeared. So yeah, now you're supposed to scrabble online or look at the online help, figure it out on your own.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Rana in Plano. Hi, Rana.
Hi. I had a question for your guest. Mm-hmm. What is your comment on the two products with ARM processors coming out within a week, the Google Chrome laptop versus the Microsoft Surface?
Yeah, so we talked about the Surface a minute ago. So this is a tablet with a detachable cover and a kickstand that does not run any programs that you've ever used before. So it doesn't run any Windows programs. And the same thing with the Chromebook from Google. This is a laptop with no guts. It's intended exclusively to be online. If you're not online, you can't do almost anything with it. So the challenge with these things, yes, they're cheaper and they're smaller and they're lighter, but the challenge is, what are you going to do with them? We're going to have to wait until there's some software to run on them.
So we're also interconnected now, and that in some ways is an advantage and a disadvantage. I mean, is there reason to have even a trace of apocalyptic fear about, you know, the implosion of the cloud or of multiple systems that are related that keep all our information safe outside of our machines?
I don't fear a gigantic apocalyptic shutdown unless, you know, the Chinese spies take down the whole internet. But online storage of only copies of things does make me super nervous. Mm-hmm. I would never entrust my photos exclusively to an online site because there have just been too many stories. You know, oh, we're sorry, something went down over the weekend, we lost it all.
Or what if they change the rules?
Yeah, or they change mm-hmm. the rules, or they go out of business, and usually they give you warning that they're going to go out of business. But what if you miss it? So yeah, the cloud stuff, the online stuff, is fantastic for backup of copies you already have. It's fantastic for syncing. I'm a big fan of the Apple iCloud stuff, so that I add something to my calendar on the phone and it's instantly replicated on my calendar at home, my assistant's calendar, my children's phones. But I would not want to have my only copy out there.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak next with Rob in Carrollton. Hello, Rob.
Hi. David, it's interesting. I got notice on your Twitter account while I was out dining at lunch that you're going to be on the radio, so I'm excited to be able to get on here. And the fact that I'm on here tells me it was meant to be. So I appreciate that. Hey, you started a few years ago a campaign called Take Back the Beep, and that is something that has been extremely interested. I've been interested in, and also, you know, would love to see, you know, come to fruition. Could you kind of explain that a little bit and where you are on that?
Yes, and thank you for that reminder. I am going to finish up what I started. So a couple years ago, I got more and more frustrated with the following technological side effect. I call you on your cell phone. I get your greeting, hi, it's Chris, leave me a message, and then I get 15 seconds of canned instructions put there by Verizon or whoever your carrier is. And it's ridiculous. It's instructions.
To leave a message,
yeah,
press one.
Right, yeah, to page this person. Page?
Who's got a pager? I've
like it's
the same
1975,
right.
You know, and then they add insult to injury.
Marcus Welby is going to pick up.
Yeah, exactly. And then when you have finished, you may hang up. No kidding.
Or press one for further options.
Oh my God. Yeah. So I realize that it's just a money scam and nobody's taking notice. It's 15 seconds a message. Verizon alone has 90 million customers. So if we each get that message a couple times a business day, it comes out to $760 million a year.
In minutes? Is that the deal?
If you take the average plan, $60 a month,
uh-huh,
and you divide it by the number of minutes, it's $750 million of our money sitting listening to those stupid messages.
So what can you do about this?
So I started a campaign in my column and on Twitter and my blog to make the people rise up and descend on the carriers, and I published the appropriate phone numbers. And we had some success. AT&T cut theirs in half, mm-hmm, as a result of the campaign. It's only 8 seconds long now. Sprint revealed that there's a secret menu command that will let you turn that message off. They just never told anybody. T-Mobile said, we'll think about it. And Verizon said, you know, go jump off a bridge. We don't care. That's the Verizon way. So a couple of them said, you know, we'll take this under consideration. And they now it's 2 years later and they haven't done anything. So I think it's time to resurrect this absurd consumer violation campaign.
It is sort of amazing the ways that people can come together now who have never met. You know, we had Rob calling in. We had Maggie writing in. They both feel sort of directly connected to you through this technology. There are people who are really alarmed by the idea of all this, and they feel like it's getting in the way of face-to-face interactions. And I don't know. I guess I'm right on the line. You and I maybe are right on the line of that generation where we have a foot in both worlds. Why do you think some people find it worry that we won't connect anymore to other people?
It's exactly what you said. It's generational. And every generation is alarmed by its children's culture. I mean, right. You know, the 50s, you young kids with your long music and loud hair, you know, it always goes back. And
your Pat Boone is ruining the world. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I was just reading this Steven Johnson book about when the tractor came out. Mm-hmm. It was considered the work of the devil. You're like, no, get that thing off of our crops. And I mean, it's just
only
it's
mules can grow. Right.
Exactly. So every new technology brings with it concern. And the fact is, there are some signs that things are different with the next generation who spend their time behind screens. True, they don't spend as much time watching TV. They don't go out and play stickball in the street. They don't do that anymore. But there are other things that they do. I mean, they're in touch with more people. They spend more time communicating, if not face-to-face. And there's some other signs, too. You know, in the 90s, college graduates were asked, what do you want most out of your first job? And the answer was money. Mm-hmm. And now the answer is, I want to change the world. So it's just too soon to condemn. Yes, there are changes. Change is happening. We're not denying that. But it's too soon to assess whether it's all good or all bad.
How does one make the career transition from Broadway conductor and arranger and composer to technology writer?
that's a funny
thing. For all the kids out there looking to make the switch.
Yeah, so I was a Broadway conductor in New York in the late 80s, and along came this software program called Finale. It's still for sale today, that lets you play on your synthesizer keyboard and it would write out the notes of what you were playing.
Mm-hmm.
First in the history of the world.
What a cool idea.
Cool idea, essential nowadays, and it was $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't afford $1,000 for a floppy disk. So I was a member at the time of the New York Mac User Group, and they had a little 8-page Xerox newsletter, and the editor said, you know what you should do? You should offer to review that software, and then they'll send you a free copy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how I got into reviewing software. And then I went from there to writing for computer magazines for 13 years and then the New York Times in 2000. So it all started out of simple greed.
And I guess now you are in a position also to use the skills that you've gained to affect your personal life as well. I just stumbled upon this morning. Congratulations, by the way. Am I correct about this, that you are planning to be married?
Yes, I am engaged. Yes.
Can you tell us how that happened? Do you mind sharing that? It's on the web, so I don't think I'm giving away anything too personal.
Yeah. I wanted to propose in a really unforgettable way to this absolutely incredible woman. So I made a fake movie trailer I found two actors who roughly looked like us, and it tells a thinly veiled version of our lives. And then I persuaded a resort movie theater where my family and hers were going to be to wedge this trailer in among the real trailers before the movie that we were going to see. And then I, to make it even better, I hid a hidden camera in a ficus plant by the screen to film her reaction as she watched it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, it's very funny because the movie David is about to propose to the movie Nikki, and I, the real David, barge into the scene and say, cut, cut, cut. No, I have to do this for real, in person. I can't get actors to do my job. And so I on screen turn to the live me sitting in the audience and make me come up in front of the screen. And so it becomes this interaction between the pre-filmed actors on the screen egging on the real me live in the theater. So it was kind of funny and kind of cool.
It's very Charlie Kaufman, actually.
Yes.
The sort of meta nature of the whole thing.
Super meta.
I think we put a link to that on our website for people who are curious to see it.
Yeah.
Do you feel like people have an obligation to know a little bit about science in order to just to be engaged citizens in the same way that we want to know a little bit about our politicians and we want to know about what's being written in terms of literature, that sort of thing?
Well, yes. But then that's like saying eat your broccoli or fasten your seatbelts. I think there's a more important reason to be aware of science, and that's the future of business, our country's competitiveness, our livelihood. What is the biggest company in the world? It's a technology company. It's Apple. If we do not beef up, if we are not anywhere on the radar for science and engineering, we lose our competitiveness. We are, you know, of the 220 countries of the world, our kids' science and math scores are like 300th place. I mean, we're really doing badly. We're giving up the American advantage in business and innovation to other countries. And science and engineering are the way out of that. This is not a new observation. We know that people are concerned about it. We know that Congress is doing something about it. The presidential candidates talk about it, the right way to go about it. One weird thing that not a lot of people realize is that it's happening in college. So a huge number of people go to college expecting to major in math, science, or engineering, and then some huge percentage of them drop out of that major by the time they graduate. So a lot of important studying going on right now to figure out why that happens. It turns out, you know, these freshman math and engineering classes, chemistry and so on, are just really brutally difficult and tedious and not fun and so on. Now, other countries seem to have no problem with that. So are we just a bunch of wussies? I don't know. But there are some efforts to, for example, make the first year project-based instead of lecture and exam. And MIT no longer gives you letter grades your freshman year. It's all about making sure you get into the swing before you freak out. But that's where we're losing a lot of it. So, yeah, we need to know science and engineering, not just because you should, and not just because it's really fascinating, but also because it's the future of the country.
David Pogue writes about technology for The New York Times, and he hosts PBS's Nova Science Now. He's in town along with Paula Apsell of Nova for a special KERA membership event this evening on the SMU campus. You can find information about that at friendsofkera@kera.org. Send an email and we will give you the details. David, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer with help today from Lindsay Connect. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.